The Guardian.
Don't you Brits feel like celebrating those 14 days of sporting glory? Of course you do. So why not do it with a strictly unofficial, but suitably stylish Philosophy Football Design t-shirt? This unique t-shirt is a wearable, chronological, and color-coded record of an unforgettable fortnight. And for Guardian and Observer podcast fans, we have a special offer of £3 off and free post and packaging. Curious? Well, to see how good this unique t-shirt looks and to take advantage of our listeners' offer, just go to guardian.co.uk/podcast offers. I dare you.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. On the show this week,
alongside our fundamental understanding of cell and molecular biology, I think coupling all those with our engineering expertise, I think the results will be mind-blowing.
The group of people, they wanted to understand the one single virus, how they enter in the body. And I wanted to understand everything in within my lifetime.
Two scientists who are at the coalface of synthetic biology. Polly Roy, Professor of Virology at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, will discuss her work on recreating the blue tongue virus. And bioengineer Dr. Suwan Jayasinghe will discuss his interest in the world of synthetic tissue. That's ahead of his talk at this weekend's Electromagnetic Field Festival. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. It's summer, so it's the time for festivals. For music fans, these are now enormous weekends with hundreds of thousands of people. What would happen, though, if instead of Glastonbury and South by Southwest, the tech and science geeks found a field, put up some tents, and started to rock out on some great ideas? Well, that's exactly what's going to happen on Friday the 31st of August as the DIY Science and Tech Festival Electromagnetic Field gets underway near Milton Keynes. The lineup is filled with the kinds of talks that Science Weekly fans would love. To give us a broader overview of the Electromagnetic Field Festival, our sister podcast Tech Weekly met with one of the founders, John T. Waring. Here's what he had to say.
We have a 1 gigabit internet connection run into the field via a very convoluted method. And every tent gets an internet connection. We have power run to every tent. We have all marquees for talks and workshops. We have a fully licensed bar. We have all sorts of weird installations. It's going to be pretty crazy.
Sounds amazing.
Yeah. And if everything comes off, apparently we will have a full workshop in the field as well. So there'll be people making things in the field while we're there, which should be quite interesting.
What is the objective here? Is this like a traditional hack event where, you know, people come together and they make things over a period of time and then present them often for awards? Or is this more like a dork bot type of gathering of geeks who want to talk about cool things
it's
that they've done?
All of the above. It's based on a format that's used in the German congresses, and it's the German Chaos Communications Camp, which happens every 4 years, and they have they get about 2,500 people in a field. It's absolutely massive, and they have talks and workshops running for, I think, 4 days instead of our three, and they also have people making and doing things and organizing things themselves amongst the camp. But it's very much a community event, and by attending, you're participating. You're not just there to observe, you're there to talk to the people and maybe to put things on yourself. And at some point, if you say something interesting, somebody will put you on a stage to say it in front of everyone else. It's a bit different to everything else I think people are used to in the UK. It's going to be very interesting.
Yeah. And who are the headline acts, as it were?
We've got researchers coming from different universities talking about their crazy things they're doing. One of my favourite ones is a researcher from UCL who no one's ever heard of, and he is talking about 3D printing organs, as in human organs. And this isn't in plastic. This is in cells. This is working human organs. And that I didn't even know that was a thing until he started talking about this. We've got people who do high altitude ballooning with robotics into near space, that kind of thing. We've got a guy who's going to run a workshop on building mechanical Turing machines, which should be quite entertaining. We've got workshops running on everything from lockpicking to blacksmithing to electronics and all sorts of crazy things. We've got people, physicists coming over to talk about the LHC. We've got people talking about sustainable housing, and it's very diverse.
So the definition of maker hacker is very, very broad then?
Massively broad. It's people doing interesting things, people doing unexpected interesting things.
One of the talks at Electromagnetic Field will be given by Dr. Suwan Jayasinghe, a mechanical engineer at University College London, who works on creating synthetic tissues for the human body. Suwan, thank you very much for coming in. Can I ask you just to start by telling me, why would we want to build artificial tissue?
Well, firstly, thank you for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here. And with regards to the question, the reason why we want to build tissues is that currently there's a huge demand for tissues as we stand. We live in a society that is continuously aging. There's a greater population of aging people as opposed to the younger people. And resulting with the aging society demanding the need for possibly aging or damaging tissues. And this requires a lot of possibly transplants and various tissues or grafts that at the moment, through the pooling system, cannot cope with.
So as we wear out and age and things get diseased, we need replacements.
Yes.
And there are many avenues to doing that, many sort of directions in which you could use to try and build this. I mean, people have tried stem cells, for example, building stem cells into functional tissues, which has got so far. Tell us about some of those techniques and how your work is involved.
There are many avenues and various schools of thought here. The very earliest work that came from the work of Alexis Carrel and Donald Thomas was that where they actually transplanted whole organs from animals and from other humans. But there again, that you're depending on a donor pool and you're also depending on somebody who might have lost their life in some sort of accident, and then you require a particular organ from that donor, for example. But there again, once again, you're going into the pool, which is limited organs. But another way is that that has come through is where scientists recently have actually managed to actually get rid of all the cells in an organ and then repopulate it with adult cells, meaning that they know where to go in that particular organ. And then the organ, as a function of time, becomes functional again. Although that is a wonderful scientific endeavor and enterprise, I think one could argue that you're dipping your hand into the organ donor pool again. So there is that problem arising. The other avenue, if you like, that comes across from the work of, as I mentioned, Alexis Carrel, was where you actually do a biopsy, disassociate the tissue into the various cell types, and then grow them in practical quantities. For example, now I think cell expansion, I wouldn't say is perfected, but we are in a position where we can pretty much draw out a stamp size biopsy from a person from a particular organ, disassociate the different cell types, and then grow those cell types outside the human body for, say, 6 to 8 weeks, and you'll be able to cover pretty much a football field.
And what kinds of cell types would you be able to get?
Well, the easiest form I would have thought is the largest organ, which is skin. But there again, you might come across problems where a particular cell type in that tissue, in any given tissue, which contains 3, 4, maybe 5 cell types or even more, may not grow at the same rate as its other cell types. And in that case, we look to stem cell biologists who've been doing some wonderful work, and you bring in your stem cells or even iPS into the equation, and then you try to get the cell, these stem cells to go in that lineage and then grow them into the quantities that you want and then build your architecture.
It's worth explaining what iPS is. It's induced pluripotent stem cells, which is where you take a cell from an adult cell and reprogram it to be a stem cell.
That's right.
Yeah. I mean, there are still issues around the chemicals and things used in there, the genetic modifications, but as a technology, it's very exciting. So your own work, though, tell me about that, because you're an engineer, you're a mechanical engineer. Yes. You've talked very eloquently just now about biology. So how did you fit those two fields together?
Well, I think engineering, the way I see it, I think engineering at present is seeing itself have much more uses than in the classical domain of engineering, where we can actually, for example, the building of a skyscraper or something of that nature requires the structure to withhold a lot of stress and strain. And therefore, that sort of knowledge could be transferred to understanding how DNA molecules are held together. For example, how a structure could be built by placing cells on one on top of the other, for example, to build a tissue, and so on and so forth. So engineering is seeing its wider applicability move from basic engineering or classical engineering more to the domain of the health sciences or life sciences.
So tell me some of the things that you've done then in terms of tissue generation.
Okay. Well, in the field that we particularly focus on is where we feel that synthetic tissues will be the next level of tissue engineering that you will require, where we would need to actually take quite a lot of natural material, but we will synthesize the polymer, for example, and we will then take the cells from your body and grow them outside, as I mentioned earlier, and then mix them together in whatever permutation and combination is required, mix it with the polymer, and then, for example, what we do is we use a technology known as bioelectrosprays to actually spray these droplets within the cells within these droplets and place them. For example, if you can picture a semi-solid basketball being dripped on top of each other, and you can build pillars and three-dimensional structures. So you will be able to actually, we are able to control what cells we put into these droplets and determine their pinpoint precision in three dimensions to actually develop, soft tissues at the moment.
So what kinds of soft tissues have you made?
We've presently built skin.
It's functional, is it?
Yes, it is functional in the sense that we've actually built it. We've created skin and we are testing it now to actually say that it mimics native tissue. And the beautiful thing we think by doing that is that you can actually use these to test various drugs, for example. And if you take cells from your body or from my body, we'd be able to personalize that medicine according to whatever allergies we may have, so that whatever creams or whatever medicines will be personalized. So we are going towards more of a understanding, a blueprint of individuals, to actually personalize a medication for them.
So that's an interesting use of that technology. I suppose it's, it must be expensive to do your own sort of skin test, and unnecessary. But in the future, I can imagine that you would use these artificial tissues for lab experiments in a range of pharmaceuticals.
Yes, of course. I mean, at the moment, what we're actually using this technology for is to actually build it in a large scale so that we can actually build, for example, 96 samples in one go on mouse cells, and then test them for various screening toxicology studies or various other studies. So, at the moment, what it is used for is actually reducing animal models. So you reduce the need for large-scale rodent experiments, and you would actually make just through cells, and you could mimic tissues and then so on.
I was also intrigued to read in some of your work that you're using these technologies to... As a way of improving drug delivery,
yes,
as well. How do you do that?
That's the beauty of UCL, actually. I've been blessed in some respects to actually work at UCL, and UCL Engineering and the Institute of Biomedical Engineering harbors a lot of interdisciplinary individuals having backgrounds in engineering, civil engineering, mechanical, right the way through to cell biology and molecular biology. And what we do is we bring all these expertise together, in this case, particularly with geneticists. And what we do is we genetically alter cells so that they produce a therapeutic element, a component, through their protein from DNA to RNA to protein. And what we are able to do is make these cells produce therapeutic elements. So it's a cell therapy that we can actually build into a structure so that we can, if you like, suture it onto the infarct area so that it not only helps in repairing and replacing and rejuvenating the damaged tissue, but it also delivers a therapeutic payload.
So give me an example of that. Is it, for example, a heart attack or something like that?
Yes.
You would be able to put this patch over the top and it would regrow, or at least make the heart tissue not only function better, but maybe regrow into new tissue.
Yes, I mean, at least for the time being, to cope with the reduction in the heart tissue that is damaged. But in future, what we hope to do is for it to be repairing and replacing it, and being there and doing something that's useful to that area.
Now, we're always talking about very exciting ideas that will save lives on this program, and you know, we're always interested in the technicalities of it. But let me ask you, as an engineer, as a someone working in this field, do you know when that sort of stuff might be available to people, you know, on the NHS, for example?
You know, I don't think it is that far away. I think we are, you know, it is probably closer than one would think. Yeah, probably about 20 years, within the next 20 years, you'll see it. Because we are at the moment going through rigorous in vitro and in vivo studies on various animal models. And once we finish that, we will be hoping to move very quickly to phase one human trials. And one of the studies that we hope to do is to try and tackle or address spina bifida.
And so human trials within a decade or so, and then, yes. and then maybe more general use beyond that.
Yes.
And of course, in 20 years of time, you imagine that stem cell biology and synthetic biology, which is the techniques you're using, will be even better than they are now.
Of course.
So, and you'll understand even more.
Of course. And, so, and
this is more of a platform than anything
exactly.
else.
Exactly. I mean, at the moment, the techniques that have been developed in my lab are actually going through generic to see it's whether the technology actually inflicts anything negative on the cells. And we've been actually able to show that it doesn't from a molecular level upwards. And as synthetic biology develops rapidly as it is, alongside our fundamental understanding of cell and molecular biology, I think coupling all those with our engineering expertise, I think the results will be mind-blowing.
Now, you're talking about all of this stuff at the Electromagnetic Field Festival. Are you excited about that? This is not a normal thing for an academic to be doing.
Well, I am excited because I think it's sometimes easier to explain science to scientists because they are at your, if you like, they understand the jargon. But I think it becomes even more interesting or probably even challenging to explain something that's so scientifically that we find very easy to understand, but it is very hard for us to put it towards a layman. And I think that's interesting because they might ask some question that we might have not thought before. You know, it's not to say that scientists know everything. We probably know nothing, and that's why we are doing research. So I think somebody with a fresh mind will definitely come out with a refreshing perspective on what we do. So I am hugely looking forward to it. And I think the advertisement for that went out with some comments such as geeks and so on. I don't really think they are geeks. I think they are very enthusiastic people who will challenge me, and I welcome that.
Suwon, thank you very much. For more information on the Electromagnetic Field Festival, go to their website www.emfcamp.org. Professor Polly Roy is one of the world's leading experts in viruses. As a molecular biologist, she's worked to understand and create vaccines for everything from SARS to the human papillomavirus. Her main area of interest, though, and the virus she's spent more than two decades examining, is an animal disease called blue tongue. This disease kills livestock and blights agriculture around the world. Professor Roy came into the studio to tell me about her work. I started by asking her to tell me how she'd built the blue tongue virus in the lab.
Well, first of all, if you think about any life in a biological life, it has to follow a whole lot of ordered events, metabolic events, to make the life. And that actually contributed by many compounds, which are carbon compounds, carbon-based compounds, that brings it together. And so they actually, that makes the life of the pathogens or any life. So virus is the smallest life as a represent anything big also. So then I wanted to understand that, okay, how this virus goes in the body and create all these problems in the animals and disease cause phenotype, you see, outside, but must go through a number of processes. So I wanted to understand all of that. Before I can do that, I have to understand the genes itself and how these viruses changing, because there are many different strains of this virus, not one type, there's 26 types now. And how do they change? Which genes changing? What part is changing? And all of these things are important to understand how the virus goes in the body and what makes them to trigger the host cells to take over and make the virus replicate or multiply in many, many, in millions forms, and then how they get out from the cell, killing the cells. So all of these stages of the virus life cycle was exciting for me to understand. And the component of the virus itself that I wanted to make it to understand that. So I have to do everything, the proteins and the genes, I have to make it to understand them.
Is it, relatively speaking, one of the more complex viruses then? Because viruses, yes, as far as I know of, are the DNA is in the middle, and then you have maybe some proteins on the outside to protect it, but then essentially that's it. They're just particles like that. I mean, the blue tongue virus, from what you described, sounds much more complex than that, almost like a cell by itself without the metabolism going on.
Yes, yes, in a way. Though there are more complex viruses. Smallpox is very complex, it's very large. Blue tongue is a complex, structurally very intriguing, not like any other virus, blue tongue or related viruses, because they have a very precise way of interaction with each other. They have a crosstalk between each component in such a way they have to be put together themselves in a precise position. And that we understood after studying a lot, that's what is happening. We did not know that before. And it has not one coat, it has several coats to protect these genes. And the genes are not one gene that mostly like have, like HIV, but it has many pieces. And why so many pieces? Why they are separated? And there's advantages with that, because each one make one type of protein. And each one type of protein have a different kind of target, for functional target, you know, they want to do. So I wanted to understand every part, which I did, everything first time done on blue tongue, actually, for all these
viruses.
Is that
the way people normally study viruses, or have you got a specific thing where you needed to understand everything that's a bit different?
No, people, for instance, the group of people, they wanted to understand the one single virus, how they enter in the body. Whole life, they only do how they enter the virus in the body.
Rather than reconstructing it and, yeah, everything else.
And I wanted to understand everything and within my lifetime. So I, because highly exciting that you can make something, create in your own hand. That's the reason. It's much more scientifically challenging, but highly exciting.
Now you've done that. You've made this, reconstructed it in a test tube. And I'm assuming, when you talked about the application to human beings, so you're understanding this virus has interesting applications in understanding rotavirus, as you mentioned. What other things have come out of the research you've been doing on this virus in terms of applications for humans and sort of understanding of general virology?
Well, for instance, almost everything we study, there is some they're interrelated in the virus and the human cells. For instance, you copy the DNA or RNA that we copy, is almost done by viruses long time ago. So how the protein that this enzyme that we call that make the copy is called polymerase or transcriptase, they make the copy of the genes. And because virus is easily manageable, we can understand that. I actually took it out, the polymerase, engineered the polymerase itself. Gene also I made separately. And then I'm trying to understand how it copies. And then, of course, what is the mechanism of the copying? And that polymerase function is very related to many other polymerases. If you look at the structure, they're exactly the same. with other polymerases like hepatitis C polymerase. So every enzyme are related, and in the cellular enzymes also. Same way, the host factors that we virus interact with different stages, same host factors are hijacked by all the viruses. So if you understand with one virus relationship with host and virus, you can understand for other viruses too. So they're very closely related, all interrelated. It's not only you study only one virus. That's why we have this virology, the whole thing. We discuss all the viruses. You know, in fact, I myself organize one particular one, and all the top people comes every 3 years, all different viruses, all different discipline, the structural physical people and chemistry people and molecular biology people and the vaccine people, everything, but it comes together, all different viruses. And we find that we can actually correlate with each other because there is a connection for everything.
And that leads me nicely onto vaccines then. All of this information, all of this crosstalk and the cross-fertilization between different people studying different viruses must be useful in strategies for vaccines.
Yes, absolutely.
So you've made a vaccine for blue tongue already.
Yes.
And I mean, it must be widely used. But some of your latest work involves using much more modern techniques, or futuristic almost techniques, synthetic
yes.
biology. We've talked about this on the podcast before. But tell me how you're re-engineering the vaccine to using these new techniques. What are you doing with it that will make it better?
Okay, so for instance, if you had the old type of vaccine that people used, those are what they call, they make a mutant or less virulent virus for polio, smallpox, yellow fever, that they passage, they mean they pass through long time and they mitigate the virulent factor slowly. But they don't know where and how it's happening. They know that it is happening. These vaccines, the live virus vaccines, are very good, but we call it scientifically attenuated vaccine.
So they're just less virulent. And you put that into people and then they don't know.
You can make them less virulent by pushing in the body or artificially in the tissue culture. But they can revert back also because they are completely in nature, natural thing happening. So you kind of take the chance. So my aim is to make the vaccine is completely safe. One type that I make the vaccine, only protein, virus-like particle, we make all the genes out but engineered that. Second vaccine that I make synthetically almost all the genes, and I tell them where I want to mutate, number of areas. Because by this time, I know the function of every gene.
So the idea is, because you know the function of every gene, you can work out where to attenuate it properly.
Yes, absolutely. Multiple site, multiple area. And then I also know which one will give you the protection, which gene, and how to manipulate them. So I can actually make the way I want it.
Now, are there unexpected results from that too? I mean, the vaccines that you talked about, the sort of older style, if you like, have worked successfully for many, many years. All these vaccines have in people being
used. But also caused problems.
They've caused problems, of course, and side effects. Do you foresee that if synthetic biology is used to make vaccines in the way you're talking and targeting these specific bits of the virus to make them less virulent, Is that a cast iron sort of guarantee that it won't go wrong?
No, because you are actually mimicking the natural virus, but you're mimicking in a way that you are taking out the danger area. So it should not.
So you need to know
logically.
You need
absolutely
to characterize the virus first.
That's why I characterize for such a long time.
You can't just do this
Can't do this, that people made the vaccine. When blue tongue came, 2006, 7, 8, all the company jump in who never made vaccine, took the virulent virus and they just killed them with the chemicals and they put it in an animal to make quickly money. However, how do they know that every particle was killed? They cannot know because there's no identification to find out every particle. One single particle alive can multiply in a body and then revert back. So that's the danger game. I don't like that at all. I would not work with. I wanted to say that I wanted to work from bottom up. I have to understand everything what I'm doing, not quickly. You can't do quickly something. So eventually you'll pay your payback is much more when you try to do quickly something. But if you have her with the knowledge what you're doing and you know exactly what it can do, and if I put that virus, synthetic virus vaccine in an animal, which I have done already, tested now, I knew already it will not have any virus.
Did it work?
Yes, tremendously. If you challenge with the virulent virus, you see, I mean, I'm not doing it, and I'm sending to the people who doesn't know what I'm giving them. So it's blindly testing, and they said, oh, we see no virulent virus replicating anymore in the sheep. I said, I know that. It cannot, because I deleted all the enzyme stuff, because it cannot. If you take out all the things, they have no way they can...
Now, viruses are well known for mutating around all sorts of
yes,
things.
Yes.
So in a sense, when you say that you've created something synthetically, a vaccine, and
but
so
it
far
cannot
worked,
multiply in the body, so you cannot make any mutation.
No, I mean, I just wonder if there is eventually... You have to keep monitoring this, I'm assuming, in the future. At some, is there still
yes,
a possibility that
just
some
just to make sure
someone,
that, because the way I made it, that you took... I took out all the essential part that is necessary to multiply. So, but how am I going to make the vaccine if I took out everything? So I have to make cells in the laboratory that I can make those vaccine. But once you make the vaccine and give it to the animal or in normal cells, these cells complement the blue tongue protein. That's where you can make it. But if you take it to another cells that doesn't complement blue tongue proteins, they cannot grow. Same way in the sheep or cattle, they don't have blue tongue proteins, they cannot grow, because it's not only one protein, it's a number of different proteins I took away. So you have to know how to do that. And you cannot know until you work for many years to understand how they work.
How applicable is that technique, though, to human viruses?
Oh, it's going on for many. Yeah. It will be. It's very applicable.
Is this the direction that you think many more vaccine development
already going on? Yes, yes, of course.
So something like flu, influenza.
They're making already.
Yeah. I mean, but that's so...
Deleting stuff.
So complex, because it mutates every 10 minutes or something, doesn't
yes.
it? The outside proteins.
Yes.
So finding a vaccine, understanding the genes and then creating a vaccine is possible, but would you have to create a new one every few months? Or how? Because that moves very quickly.
Flu has a complicated story, but nevertheless, they still have certain areas of the virus that can protect for all of the type.
Now, I mean, given how much you know about viruses, and you talk to other virologists all the time and you're in conferences and things, given how much you know about how quickly and easily, or how difficult it is, I suppose, to make vaccines, do you ever worry about human pandemics, global pandemics at all? I mean, is that something that worries you, or do you think we'll be able to deal with anything that comes along?
We'll be able to deal with that.
You think?
Yes, yes. It's not going to happen. Just think about how they control how fast SARS. We didn't have anything.
SARS was this severe acute respiratory syndrome. It came along
yeah.
in 2003,
yeah.
appeared and disappeared very quickly.
Yeah, but even though they said H5N1 coming long time, and I was asked that time, and I said, no, it'll take time. No, it's not that easy.
Well, that's good to know that you're not worried about these things.
No, I'm not worried.
Professor Roy, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thanks to Professor Polly Roy there, and also to Dr. Suwan Jayasinghe. That's all we have for this edition of Science Weekly. You can keep up to speed with breaking science news at any time on guardian.co.uk/science. But from me, Alok Jha, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
Don't you Brits feel like celebrating those 14 days of sporting glory? Of course you do. So why not do it with a strictly unofficial but suitably stylish Philosophy Football Design t-shirt? This unique t-shirt is a wearable, chronological, and color-coded record of an unforgettable fortnight. And for Guardian and Observer podcast fans, we have a special offer of £3 off and free post and packaging. Curious? Well, to see how good this unique t-shirt looks and to take advantage of our listeners' offer, just go to guardian.co.uk/podcast offers. I dare you.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.